This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Hotel Mars, Episode N. David Livingston is here, my colleague and co-host and co-pilot, and we're in our star machine. We're going 40 light years out to a red dwarf called TRAPPIST. And that red dwarf has a number of exoplanets. And thanks to our guide to that those exoplanets this morning, we're going to learn of a new discovery that is, well, promising. I'll be careful. We welcome Dr. Nesta Espinosa, mission scientist for exoplanet science at the Space Telescope Science Institute, an associate astronomer at the Institute, associate research scientist at Johns Hopkins University. Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. TRAPPIST is a red dwarf. TRAPPIST-1e, one of the planets circling TRAPPIST, every 6 days I read, is of great interest to you and your astronomer colleagues. Why? What have you discovered using the James Webb Space Telescope? What might you have discovered? Good evening to you.
Good evening. This is an exciting discovery. Yeah, indeed. TRAPPIST-1 is one of the most exciting systems that is out there. TRAPPIST-1e, it's a planet that is very interesting for all of us because it's in what we like to call the habitable zone of its star, which means it's at a distance to its star that it's not so close such that it's too hot, and it's not that far away that it's too cold. In fact, it's at the right distance such that if it had an atmosphere, big if, it could sustain liquid water, right? And that makes it very, very exciting. So what we're doing with the James Webb Space Telescope is trying to figure out what if any, the atmospheric composition is on TRAPPIST-1e. We're trying to figure out if it has an atmosphere, and if it does, what kind of atmosphere it could be. And we have made the first four observations of a total of 19 observations that are in total scheduled. And these are the results that went out last week on this planet. It's exciting because it's our first look at the possibilities of an atmosphere in this exoplanet.
Professor, a detail. What is the transit method? How are you doing this?
Yeah, so we're doing this exactly through the transit method. It's a very clever idea that was popularized by some exoplanet scientists back in the 2000s. So this is like, 25 years ago. The transit method, what it does is when the planet passes in front of the star, it blocks part of the starlight from our point of view at Earth. Now, if you think about this, you have to be very lucky. Not every planet around stars out there do this. They have to be aligned in such a way that the planets pass in front of the stars. And from our point of view on Earth, they block part of that starlight. When that happens, something very miraculous happens too. When that starlight is hitting the planet, part of that starlight is also going through the exoplanet atmosphere. And then the atmosphere interacts with this starlight, with a little bit of the starlight. And then we receive all of this information here on Earth or in our space observatories like James Webb. That means that we play this little cosmic detective game with these systems in which we try to figure out what starlight has been absorbed or has interacted with the exoplanet atmosphere during this transit. We call this the technique of transmission spectroscopy because it's really, we're studying this light that is transmitted through the atmosphere that you receive here on our instruments in space and on Earth. So this is the method that we're using to constrain the atmospheric composition of these planets, including TRAPPIST-1e.
David, you have a question.
A couple of them, but the first is, are you able with James Webb to now detect biosignatures, or are you emerging toward that capability?
So, first of all, I have to say that James Webb was not designed to do biosignatures. However, we're pushing it to make the detection of molecular features that then could become these biosignatures. So, for instance, we're going step by step. Like the very first step is to try to detect an atmosphere. That's step one. If you detect that atmosphere, then you go to step two, which is, okay, which molecules are in this atmosphere? And from step two, you go to step three, which is, okay, from all these possible molecules, which could be biosignatures? And then you study them in detail. However, even if you do study them in detail, there's a lot of work that has to be, going on in the astronomical community, which is, even if you detect some of these so-called biosignatures, that typically is pairs of molecules, like the amount of carbon dioxide to methane, for instance, is kind of weird, or the amount of oxygen or ozone with respect to carbon dioxide or methane is weird. Once you do these detections, then you go to the whiteboard, you go to your models, and then you ask, okay, can this amount of these different elements, can those be explained by something that is not life? And that starts a discussion on its own. So right now, I wouldn't say that James Webb is capable of detecting like a silver bullet kind of signatures on these atmospheres to claim life, but it can build those steps such that that discussion starts. And maybe at some point we'll be out of options. And the only thing that we will be able to say is, well, we cannot explain this with our models from like a non-biological signature. So it's very likely perhaps something related with life. But it's doing that final confirmation that this is absolutely life. As you are well aware, in science, we're not very good at doing that, right? There's always possibilities and probabilities rather than certainty. Which is something that I love about science, by the way. I prefer to live with uncertainty than with answers that might be wrong, I guess.
The atmosphere that might be TRAPPIST-1e, you've reasoned this from studying TRAPPIST-1b, which we determine is a bare rock. How does that work?
Yeah, what you're referring to is it's a follow-up program to these four observations in which we're using TRAPPIST-1b, which is another planet in the system, to kind of as a guiding light for TRAPPIST-1e. So let me explain what's happening there. So when you take these transit observations, whatever is happening on the surface of the star is very important. If the star wasn't like an immaculate star and just like, you know, if you take a photo of the sun, if it was like as perfect as the sun with very little spots and faculae and flares, then our jobs will be very easy. Like the spectrum, the data that you would observe, it will just be, you know, basically the atmosphere of the planet during these transits. However, if there's any spot or faculae or any flares going around, that can distort that signature. It's part of the technique. Like anything that is happening in the star is distorted by that. Now, the beauty of our observations is that we cannot, in a given observation, if we time these observations right, we can observe not only one planet transiting, but even several of them transiting contemporaneously. Like within an hour or two, we can observe several transits of the planets. And in particular, TRAPPIST-1b is another planet in the system for which all the data that we have gathered so far with GIROLGST points to this object of having possibly, like very likely being a bare rock. So basically, we believe that most of its atmosphere, if not all of it, has been stripped by the star. And we actually expected this before these observations with James Webb, because the planet is very, very close to its star. So any bombardment of energy from the star, really, it's very easy to blow that atmosphere off. That's beautiful because if we get contemporaneously data from this planet E, which is the one that is inhabitable zone, and B, which is the one that we believe is a piece of, or very closely to a piece of rock, then any distortion that we see on the planet B, then we can attribute to the star, and then we can remove that from planet E. So we use planet B as like an anchor of what's happening on the star, and we use that to correct for planet E. So that's a follow-up program that a grad student working with me, Natalie Allen, and myself were leading. It's a program that it's ongoing. We're like two-thirds of the way through all of those observations, which hopefully should be finished by the end of the year. And it's a very promising technique. It's very interesting. It's like a clever twist and that we're using to analyze. But these very first four observations that we published last week, those ones were not using that that twist. These were just observations of planet E.
David, yes. You have a question.
One of the articles I read said you're using the telescope to juxtapose the atmosphere of B onto E, if I understood that correctly. How do you do that?
Yeah, so this is like a more than juxtapositioning the atmospheres. What we're trying to do is use any signals that are in B, which should actually come from the star, to use those signals to remove this stellar signature from E. Because we know that the spectrum of E, these first observations confirm this, that we published last week. These first four observations confirm that the data from the signatures of TRAPPIST-1e, they are distorted by the star. Now, we've done our best and we've used like very kind of advanced techniques to correct for that. But a much cleaner way of correcting for that is hopefully observing those same distortions in another planet. And that's exactly what we're using with these other observations in TRAPPIST-1b and E. We're using the distortions on B that we know should come from the star to correct the distortions that are appearing on E in the planet E data to get the signal out of the atmosphere.
What I learned, Professor, is that so far you can move aside a expectation of a Venus atmosphere. You can move aside an expectation of a Mars atmosphere, which is very little, not too hot, not too cold. And what you've settled on possibly is a nitrogen-heavy atmosphere with traces of methane. Have I said all that correctly?
That's broadly correct. So the fact that there's a lot of possibilities still is very exciting. And indeed, like one of the peaks on like the most likely scenarios are the ones that you mentioned. But it's not out of the question yet to have an atmosphere like Venus with clouds. So what we were able to rule out is, or make, not rule out, but make very like make an unlikely assumption of if TRAPPIST-1e had an atmosphere like Venus, but without the clouds that we observe in Venus, we should have likely detected something on the data that we have, but we didn't. However, the data is still consistent with like a Venus twin, to be honest, in which you have this cloud, very, very cloudy planet on it. That's, you know, still allowed within the realm of the data. But it's true that the most likely solutions from this first set of data are these nitrogen or traces of methane solutions that would, if you imagine that, that would resemble something like, you know, maybe on Earth, which is within the realm of possibilities, but also something like Titan or maybe even something else. So I want to clarify, though, that we are not really sure. There's a bunch of possibilities on the atmosphere still allowed within data, including, again, the ones that I just mentioned. But that's exciting on its own. So the paradigm of the planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system has been pretty grim so far. So we started observing TRAPPIST-1b and C, which are the closest planets to the star. And all the data points to B, at least, to be very consistent with like a bare rock with a completely strip of its atmosphere, or having just maybe a tiny, very tiny remnant of an atmosphere. TRAPPIST-1c is still in the air, which is the next one in terms of closeness to the star. A couple of weeks ago, there was a result by TRAPPIST-1d in which they were ruling out a bunch of atmospheres. So, you know, kind of the possibilities of finding something like the Earth was hard. And now we have TRAPPIST-1e, on which these very first observations are still on the fence. You know, it can definitely still be a bare rock, or it could have an atmosphere. But the dream of having an atmosphere there is still there. And that's super exciting. Like the fact that the dream is still alive for having an atmosphere and a habitable sun planet and a red dwarf. It's there, and that's where we're investigating.
Yeah, Earth size, check. Nitrogen rich, possibly, check. Trace methane, check. You're on a roll, Nestor.
Yeah, all those possibilities are still within the realm of possibilities, and that has us very excited. And that's exactly how the story went, is that we had these four observations. We were working hard on those observations, and we used those observations to propose a deeper program with James Webb, right? These were the first four observations. And that was the crazy thing. Like we said, okay, this is really exciting. We're going to propose to observe 15 of these transits, right? And I don't know if I make the numbers there correctly, but going from four observations to 15 is a huge ask to the telescope allocation committee. There's like an actual committee that every year decides what should be observed on James Webb. And proposing 15 transits is a completely crazy thing. I remember when we were working out this proposal with Natalie, the student in my group. I remember the first time she came and we started discussing, it's like, are you sure we can even make this happen? And like, yes, like the science is super exciting. Let's do it, right? And it got approved, which is very exciting. And that's happening right now.
Okay, we're going to have fun here for just a moment. Deep astronomy notwithstanding. Dr. Nestor Espinosa, Associate Astronomer, Space Telescope Science Institute, Associate Research Scientist, Johns Hopkins University, David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show himself. This is Hotel Mars, and when we come back, We're giving Nestor an unlimited budget.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.